So as both of you know, I have spent the vast majority of my professional career working in restaurants, on and off, mostly on, but something that I've enjoyed here and there. One of the more interesting facets of restaurant work seems to be the vast array of different and interesting dishwashers that one encounters upon one's path. And I may have mentioned this gentleman to you guys at some one point or another.
But please tell me.
I did work with a gentleman named Popcorn.
That's what I wanted to hear.
Some years back as I was
gentleman
doing, yeah.
Thank you, fine sir.
As my path had taken me to Ruth Chris Steakhouse. I do want to preface this, however. There was another probably just about equally as entertaining gentleman I worked with at an Outback Steakhouse in Indiana. His name was Sam, and he worked with his brother Tyrone, also a dishwasher at the restaurant. The entertaining thing about Sam was that, well, he'd done two tours of duty in Vietnam, which is not in and of itself terribly funny.
But that was a long time ago.
Yeah, but he had a really bad alcohol problem. And
that's the funny part.
No, what was funny is when he'd come in and he was sober, you couldn't understand a word he'd say. But as he drank throughout the night, he would get more...
lucid?
You could lucid. Thank you.
As he drank, what, he'd come in with a hip flask? And
He was drinking something throughout the night.
You could just tell,
you could smell
because
it
his speech got better and better. Gentle Library by the end of the evening.
Anyhow, the gentleman Popcorn was here in Austin at Ruth Chris, and so I worked with this guy. He was an interesting cat. He would drink at least one bottle of cold duck every night after work. Andre,
what
champagne.
Is cold?
Cold duck is Andre's sort of flagship champagne.
It's their like, flagship.
It's like a $3 bottle of champagne.
Andre the Giant or
Andre the sparkling wine producer,
which is a giant,
which
I'm sure, in its own right.
As good of a wrestling name, really.
Sure. Yeah.
At any rate, I worked with Popcorn for probably 3 or 4 weeks, and finally it just it got to me. I'm like, so hey man, why do they call you Popcorn? And I swear to God, he says, because I gets down. And I'm like, all right. And I just kind of went on about my night and was thinking, I'm a bright guy. I'll be able to put this together at some point.
Did you?
No. No, I really didn't.
Excellent.
So I let a couple weeks go by, and finally I'm like, so, hey, man, you remember when I asked you why they call you Popcorn and you said, because I gets down? What does that mean? And he clarified for me. He said, because I like to break and pop. And he did a little, arm gesture.
It's like a high five or
man, it was like, are you familiar with a little something called Electric Boogaloo?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, something along those lines.
Break and two.
Yes. Yeah. But the pop part became Popcorn. And so I have no idea what his real name was.
Did he ever break in the kitchen?
He constantly. Did a little arm move.
Yeah, did he ever break?
He broke
anything?
Some dishes.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
He popped them locked.
Maybe. Yeah. It's probably
all
not
right.
The way you want to go down.
Let's get going here.
We should probably get to the business at hand.
I'm Shane Bartell.
I'm Ryan Newsom.
I'm Kevin Newsom.
And this is Somebody Likes It. Thank you, thank you, thank you, everybody. Welcome back to Somebody Likes It. I'm Shane Bartell.
I'm Ryan Newsom.
I'm Kevin Newsom.
So we wanted to, before we got started today, I think you wanted to say something, Kevin?
I did. I wanted to give a quick shout-out to our friends at Aviary. They're hosting us tonight. If you find yourself in Austin and you're in the South Lamar area, it's kind of a mashup of a cool little wine and craft beer bar with a lot of home decor stuff from around the world. So anyway, our friends at Aviary were kind enough to give us the space tonight to put together the podcast. We want to show those guys some love and give them a shout out. So there it is. Thanks, Aviary. And Shane, let's get to the item at hand.
I want to say real quick one more thing about Aviary. We're sitting in it's closed tonight, and we're sitting downstairs in this beautiful space, and we have this lamp, this one light bulb in the middle of all three of us, and it kind of makes me think we're going to have a Ouija board / seance here in a second.
I thought that was it symbolized
our
hive mind.
We'll do that after the podcast.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's private time?
That's private time.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, guys.
Mommy and daddy time.
Okay, so I want to tell you both that having gone through this album that we're going to discuss tonight before we start talking about it, I never pegged myself as a sadist until I actually started listening to it. I knew it would be funny to listen to, but I started listening to it, and about halfway through the album, I kind of was gleeful that the two of you had to go with me on this journey.
Yeah, I had already pegged you as a sadist.
I hadn't yet.
Yeah, I mean, that's one way to put it. I think having to go through is the right part of that sentence. This was absolutely.
Well,
like
I could only conclude that you were punishing us somehow, right. That we had, you know, engaged in some sort of awful indiscretion, and you were just going to show us.
Yeah.
Although, between this and the last record you chose, like I've gotten to a place where I just expect that, like, every third is going to be some sort of, like, affront to my soul for a little while. So I'm on board, though.
Possibly so. Well, okay, so this week we are listening to Bon Jovi, or have listened to, and hopefully you'll listen
to
some.
We've listened to in the past.
And are talking
and
about.
And never will again. Bon Jovi, Slippery When Wet, their epic, huge, 25 million selling album from 1986, the album that put Bon Jovi, for better or for worse.
Worse.
I don't even know if that's arguable. Worse. I'm going to say worse. Yeah, for worse, put them on the map. And, so I'm just going to open that up to you guys.
I don't even know. I mean, so I do think the one thing that we could talk about that we have mentioned in previous podcasts are the difference between, like, when songs aren't songs anymore, you know, like when a song becomes an anthem.
When it's been played so much. We will rock you.
Sure. So there were elements of this record, in fairness, that I didn't really feel like, you know, you don't really have to dive into Living on a Prayer and try and uncover some nugget of truth. Like, I've heard that shit.
No,
whether it is in the skating rink of my soul.
I skipped forward on that one. Yeah, I've heard it enough.
And then there are other tracks. One, you know, I also find, like, to the point of what you were saying earlier about how you hear these differently and how you can listen to it through kind of the prism of, okay, this is hilarious, not just because, like, it's bad in a special way, but also because I'm making my friends trudge through the same shit pile. So
I'm twirling my mustache as you say that, by the way.
So there's that.
Slightly whiplash over here.
There's that, and I could hear some of it. It's like, you know how you win at karaoke but through style points and not through necessarily being the best singer in the room? Like, the best karaoke performances are performances, and they're not necessarily the people who are the most on key.
All right,
and that's kind of how I feel about parts of this record. It's like, I could see it and listen to it through the, you know, the hammered goofball from 20 years ago that thought he was having an epic, like, you know, hair rock moment when, in fact, he was, you know, about to go home empty-handed.
Yeah, the things were, it was all coming to an end, screeching to a halt, as they say.
I just kept flashing back to a lot of Acid Wash.
In torn Lycra shirts.
Yeah. Crispy bangs, like big poofy bangs.
Mm-hmm. Crispy bangs. That's my writing name.
Crispy bangs.
By the way, so one of the things that Shane and I were talking about is how we, before we came on the air, like, or started taping the podcast, is how we source material differently. And one of the things that I did manage to find that I'm probably guessing that you guys didn't, was what the original cover for this record was.
Oh, well,
I've seen it.
Like a wet t-shirt.
Oh,
contest.
So
there's the one, like, so we're looking at the picture now, and there's the, you know, the edgy, like, I've just written on a wet window that became the final record cover, and then the other one is this, you know, sort
buxom
torn shirt looking lass who
it looks like she's so buxom it looks like she's been photoshopped, even though that wasn't
that
around then.
So anyway but you look at it and you look at it through the prism of 2014 and you think, well, that's not that risque. Like, what were they afraid of, really?
Well, probably Walmart not carrying it. Or
I think that's exactly
maybe that's
what
true.
Happened, but
wouldn't surprise me.
I don't know. Well, one of the things that I wanted to say about this album that I kept coming back to time and time again. It seems like Jon Bon Jovi plays a couple of characters, mostly two guys. And one guy is
talentless.
Like, No, that's real life.
And hack?
No, again, that's real life. Maybe with the character, he's on one hand, he's like this wholesome. Well, no, let me see three characters. He's got kind of this wholesome, hard rock with quote. I'm doing air quotes. Air quotes around
rock
it.
Quotes.
And he's got this hard drinking. He says something about the bottle, I think, on three different songs. He references gunslingers all the time, the Wild West, riots, being in a riot, getting out in the streets, you know, taking to the streets. And then he also wants to be the lover. There was one of the songs starts with, what song is it? It starts with, it's Social Disease. For about 10, 15 seconds, there's orgasmic noises going on, and then it stops, and the woman, you can clearly hear the woman say, is that it? And then the song comes in, and the social disease is, he's saying in the song, love is a social disease. You can't have it both ways. It can't be a love song about it's a social, it makes no sense at all. But then it starts with 15 seconds of, and if you go back and listen to it, it sounds like there's various women in the throes of orgasm, not just one. But one says, is that it? Is that all? So Jon Bon Jovi wants to play a lot of characters on this album, and one of them is the guy that would be taking home that girl with the buxom girl on the original cover of Slippery
Wind
Wet.
That just occurred to me as a real Spinal Tap moment, you know? Like,
it's all Spinal Tap moments.
You know, like, you know, the record company is getting in touch with Bon Jovi's manager saying, look, we can't have this cover. And you just flash us back to, you know, the whole smell the glove scene in
Moments.
Spinal Tap. Yeah. Well, you should have seen the cover they wanted to do. I assure you it wasn't a glove.
Well, the other thing that I couldn't help but notice, like, or wonder when you look at that original cover is like, okay, so if it's a situation where, like, that's the epitome of the hot girl, like, where is he picking her up? It looks like she works at a car wash. Like,
that's exactly
like,
it, yes.
It just is like, if you do the math and you back it out, it doesn't quite line up.
Oh, I just, according to their Wikipedia page, the working title of the album was Wanted Dead or Alive, but later the band decided to name the album Slippery When Wet after visiting the number 5 Orange Strip Club in Vancouver. Again, Bon Jovi wants to have it all the ways. And that's not a sexual
classy reference.
Classy
with a K.
So the beginning of this album, the very first song on the album, was called "Let It Rock," and I have a hard time. I couldn't figure out what this. It's another thing. Like, there's very confused and awkward metaphors, a lot in this record. And for example, "Wanted Dead or Alive," the gunslinger. Walk these streets, a loaded six string on my back. You know, all this kind of stuff. It's very forced and very. This song, I can't figure out what he's talking about. Is it a riot? He's saying, you know, let it rock, let it roll.
I've found that just. I don't know if this is what you're getting at or not, but I found just looking back at the hair metal genre of the 80s in particular, the word rock or rocking just had its own inherent danger. You know, like the whole Twisted Sister, what do you want to do with your life? I want to rock. You know, like,
fair enough.
What does that even mean?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. What does this mean when Bon Jovi
said, "Let it rock"? What is it?
In what way
is it rocking?
honestly,
it's like an old folks' home.
if you read the lyrics from the song, he's talking about like people in the streets here. Let's see. I'll read a little sample in the beginning. Okay. I saw Captain Kidd on Sunset tell his boys they're in command while Chino danced a tango with a broomstick in his hand. It's all right if you want to cross that line to break on through to the other side. Let it rock, let it go. You can't stop a fire burning out of control. What?
Well, it's wisdom.
They're
really
rioting.
Cool. Yeah.
Are they rioting? He's got a broomstick in his hand. Like he's literally dancing a tango with a broomstick? Or is he beating somebody up with that broomstick?
You know Chino.
that silly guy.
Dancing the tango with a broomstick.
But
know?
I do feel like there was this, like, it's almost like, this is probably a weird example. It's almost like a minuet, right? Or like.
Yes,
or like,
that is a weird example.
It is a weird, but I'll go a step further. I'll further that analogy. Or it's like war during revolutionary times where there was a very, like, sort of, the mantra during that time was like to rebel against something, like sort of to rebel against is your parents or the school or like whatever the thing was. And it was all like, it all sounds so cheeseball when we listen to it now. But at the time, it felt like that was like some sort of crazy rallying cry, but like nobody ever said, what are we rallying against? We don't know. Like,
yeah, right. No, you know. Yeah. Like, well, your stupid rules, man.
Yeah, it's all like red. What is the, what's the, the Red Hawk? It's not Red Hawk. Anyway, the movie where the Red Dawn? Red Dawn. That's exactly what it was.
I was actually thinking more Footloose, but I get your.
But it's the same. Yeah. It's essentially the same ethos, right? Like, yeah. They're. It's either the Russians or dancing.
Or your parents.
Yeah.
There's another. You know what? Why don't we listen to a little bit of Let It Rock? Kevin, can you make that happen
for
us? All right.
Let's do it. This is Let It Rock.
Rock by John Bon Jovi. Does that rock?
Oh, quite.
Does it?
Quite a bit.
Kevin, does that song rock?
I found that it was rolling.
More rolling. Well, than it was rock. It does say to let it roll.
I was
going to
say it implores one to both rock and roll.
It's possible that
I don't think it's an
and or
thing, though.
I could have been doing it out of order.
Can you do both simultaneously?
I think that's where the and is, rock and
well,
roll.
Maybe if it's a coordinated
effort.
He's never
saying rock and roll.
You could have some do some rocking while others are balancing out with rolls.
Well, and it wasn't telling us to rock and or roll. It was saying let it rock and or roll.
Right. I think that's it. It's sort of like a Hands Across America type of thing. Like we're joining the nation together. That. Like he's putting out rock and roll.
But having in more seriousness, like having listened to that song, like do you feel like you get it more?
No,
like, that's the thing. Is like
no, you don't
not even remotely
get it. Yeah. So as I was listening to this record over the last week and cursing Shane's name, you know, it occurred to me that, you know, in the great pantheon of hair metal bands and what have you, like, you know, probably, you know, the first truly great one would have been like Van Halen, and then you go through like Guns N' Roses.
What do you mean by truly great?
Well, I mean just like, you know, there's some legitimacy there to like, you know, that they had
discussion.
They had their moments, but it occurred to me that Bon Jovi, like if you translate hair metal bands into 80s TV sitcoms, that like, you know, Guns N' Roses, like Appetite for Destruction is actually a solid record. And, you know, I could compare that to like, you know, Cheers or The Cosby Show. You know, it holds up. But Bon Jovi's Slippery When Wet is more like Family Matters. You know, like wildly, inexplicably popular and not terribly good.
Does that make John Bon Jovi the Urkel?
Yes.
I think the Urkel is Tico Torres.
As soon as they put this record out, I'm sure he was like, did I do that?
One of the things that I was reading.
Good answer.
That I was reading about this.
Survey says. Sorry, go ahead.
No. Please interrupt me. That wasn't sarcastic at all. One of the things that I was reading was that they weren't as successful as they wanted to be the album before. While moderately successful, it wasn't as successful as they wanted to be, which again goes back to. Oh, wait, we weren't talking about that on the air, about John Bon Jovi's parents going to buy him a lot of albums for him. He's such a sweet boy. He's a sweet boy.
Johnny. Yeah.
We were just wondering how it was that he managed to sell that many. And so
his folks were wealthy.
Yeah, we put it out there that maybe his parents were buying them, maybe on the DL, maybe not. But
yes.
Paying young people to go to their concerts.
Oh, my God, I have to read that to you. Speaking of, I totally forgot about that. It's on Wikipedia. They decided to go away from their previous harder sound, which we'll get into that at the end of this podcast. I've got a song.
Big time air
quotes. I've got
there.
A song by their previous harder sound, and you can see how much harder it actually was. And they and their label got Desmond Child, like super stud songwriter. Actually, I mean, he wrote "Livin' La Vida Loca." He wrote, I mean, he's up through the mid 2000s. He was still charting top 10 and number one hits. He has more top 40 hits as a co-writer, I think, than any person in history. But don't quote me on that.
He was Pharrell before Pharrell was Pharrell.
For real?
Without the street cred. Or without as much of the street cred.
Right, yeah. Does Pharrell have
current
street
terms.
Cred?
In current terms. That's a story for now.
You and your... I don't think... You say things sometimes that you think that... I don't know how much street cred...
Whatever. We can go down that road another time. I have thoughts. But still... Anyway. So that guy was a professional songwriter that wrote a lot of popular songs, which was the analogy that I was trying to
A lot of popular say. Songs. A lot of horrible yet...
Sure.
Quite popular songs. Yeah. So one of the things he did, according to the Wikipedia page, was he went to New Jersey, Desmond Child did, and they worked on the songs in the basement of Richie Santora's mother's house.
That's awesome.
Which is amazing
like
in and of
made
itself.
Them meatballs.
Yeah, right. what I really, really love is that when they worked – they worked on all these songs. They figured out some songs. Like, he helped them co-wrote You Give Love a Bad Name, Living on a Prayer, and some other shitty songs on that album. But this is a quote from the Wikipedia page. Hiring professional songwriter Desmond Child as a collaborator, the group wrote 30 songs and auditioned them for local New Jersey and New York teenagers, basing the album's running order on their opinions. What?
They basically workshopped it. I mean, that is so cynical.
They went out and played for New York and New Jersey teenagers and then gave – it's like a focus group and then gave them focus group cards.
It isn't like a focus group. It's exactly a focus group.
It is
group.
A focus
That's
group,
totally what
right.
It is. Yeah,
right. I mean, it worked.
Yeah.
That is one of the most horrible sounding albums. I have this written all over my notes here, how horrible. Obviously, there was so much money put into the recording of that album. But if you go back and the keyboards are just – super high in the mix, in this hard. It's completely. It does not gel in any way with the hard rock guitars, and it sounds horrible. But at the same time, it sounds like it's trying to be. It's trying to have something for everybody. The keyboards in there to sort of placate the mothers of the kids that wanted these songs. The crunchy guitars in there, so dudes that were driving their Camaros would buy it. It's a very cynically fucking.
No, it's like
made
it is. It's a checkbox formula.
Oh yeah,
and I do think it's like the musical equivalent of in advertising parlance of make the logo bigger. Like it's something that everybody like. Okay, well I can understand in a lowest common denominator way what you get out of that, but what do you really get out of it? And the thing that I also thought was really interesting was the idea that they were. Conscious that they were tapping into something with the record previous to this, but they didn't feel like they got all the way there.
Right.
And so
I just kept going back to that famous P.T. Barnum quote, which is nobody ever went broke underestimating the intelligence of the American people.
No, that's true.
I don't know how much there is to say. I don't think that can be overstated.
Well, this feels like a pretty decent time to trot out this week's Rolling Stone review.
I actually haven't looked this up.
When you said this week's, I initially thought like they're still writing about it 25 years
ago. Well, right, yeah.
We really hated this or loved this album.
It's like that guy's probably still smashing his face into a keyboard somewhere. But this was written by Jimmy Guterman, Rolling Stone. I won't read the whole thing, but I will hit some of the highlights. He says, how many cliches can you squeeze into a pop song? Probably not as many as John Bon Jovi can. Listen to Raise Your Hands from his new album Slippery When Wet. I know, that's two already, but titles don't count. John Bon Jovi lets loose with Nasty Reputation, Sticky Situation, Ain't Nobody Better, Show Me What You Can Do, Under the Gun, Out on the Run, Set the Night on Fire, Playing to Win, Pretty Impressive, and that's only the first verse. anyway, maybe we'll come back to this a little bit later, but he kind of culminates the whole review by saying, on Slippery When Wet, Bon Jovi sounds like a bad fourth generation metal, a smudgy Xerox of Quiet Riot.
So, yeah, I'll buy that. With more shitty keyboards in there, so the
Was there a star number that corresponded to that?
I want to say it was one. Like
that
one
sounds
star.
About right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, but this guy was
just
not
being
a fan.
Generous.
Not a fan.
So yeah. When he this is one of the next two songs that I want to play clips from are perfect examples of the cliches. And one, and Ryan and I were before you got here, Kevin, we were talking about this. There's a song, Never Say Goodbye, which I, for some inexplicable reason, I never owned this album. I never listened to it. I mean, Living on a Prayer and
sure,
You Give Love a Bad Name. And yeah, I've heard
osmosis.
It millions and millions of times. Yeah. But there's a song, Never Say Goodbye, that I know every word to, every single fucking word for some inexplicable reason I know. And the song basically starts, and let me tell you what this whole song's about, and I'll sum it up how I feel about it. In the beginning of the song, he's sitting in a bar with a bunch of strangers, but the bottle, again, he says he's using
my
the bottle.
Friend.
The bottle is his only friend. And then he starts going into, remember, he's like remembering his high school years. He's like, we were racing cars and skipping school. I'll tell you the whole fucking song. With a six-pack and a radio, we didn't need
well,
no place to go.
You need to address this, Shane. Remember when we used
to... No. That's the best line in the whole song. No,
I mean,
let me get to it.
All right. All
no,
right.
No, no,
I don't
no. That's a cherry on top of this fucking shitty Sunday right here, son. and then he's like, remember at the prom that night, you and me, we had a fight? I mean, it's just straight out of, like, 16 Candles or some kind of shitty 80s movie. But the best line in the whole song, and the best line maybe in all of pop music ever is... He's talking in the beginning of the song about how they used to go park late at night, and he's like, remember when we lost the keys, and you lost more than that in my back seat, baby.
That's right. he's talking about her virginity.
thank you.
I thought they were just learning how to park together.
What was that, her retainer?
But he... And again, Bon Jovi trying to wear all hats. So basically, this dude is sitting in a fucking bar... not trying to meet any real adults with a bottle for some reason, though. I guess it's like, hey, bartender, skip the shot glass. Give me the whole fucking bottle.
It's bottle service.
right, exactly. It's some shitty New Jersey service. Town in 1984. And he's just sitting there chugging on this bottle, crying to himself about never saying goodbye to his high school years. It's like a Funhouse Mirror Uncle Rico story. I wish you could go back in time. I just want to go back in time and... race cars and skip school again.
I bet I can throw this football.
And
over
they
that
romanticize
mountain.
The whole goddamn song. And the whole song, there's never. And by the way, it never goes back to. There's never any resolution about him being an adult. The only time it references him being an adult are the first two lines of the song when he's in the fucking bar. And the rest of it is him pining over his.
Well, maybe this is a New Jersey thing because you know Bruce Springsteen's got Glory Days.
No, but that's not fair because Glory Days is definitely sarcastic.
Say is maybe he on some level understands while that song is being put together who he actually is, which is somebody that when he looks back on this song 20 years later will go like, well, that was the best that I had. Like That's as good as it gets.
Well,
right
you know,
there.
I never thought of this before because I'd never read this before until a few hours ago. But you know, since they were debuting all these songs for teenagers, I mean, it would make sense that a 17-year-old kid or an 18-year-old kid or somebody that just had graduated high school would look back on their high school years, you know,
super fondly,
and as though you know.
Well, you know, at the time, you think this is, you know, this is all the best time of my life. You know, like, it's very intense. You know, you just got pubes.
I don't think that...
Thanks. That's where we're going. But to the greater point, like, you spent, like, at that time, and there are people who never move out of their hometown, and so maybe that's the regional thing. I mean, I think
target
that
market.
Yeah.
No, it's all fucking like, cynical. They're not trying to pitch that to anybody. It's not a New Jersey thing. It's as cynical and universal as they can possibly be.
I think it happens everywhere.
Absolute definition of lowest common denominator.
Why don't we listen to a clip from Never Say Goodbye?
Remember when we used to park out, pulled the street out in the dark? Remember when we lost the keys and you lost more than that in my backseat, believe it? Remember how we used to talk about busting out, we'd break their hearts together forever.
greatest lines in the history of rock and roll. I think we can all agree on that. Can we agree on
certainly,
that?
Certainly, certainly.
I'm sure. You're being sarcastic, but... Well, I mean, I am too.
I'm just
That's
glad
true,
that we had the opportunity to pull out our big lighters and wave them above our head and sway.
Yeah, but unfortunately, we set the smoke alarms off, and then that's a whole other story.
The other thought that I had is, like, so technically, if you never say goodbye, like, you never leave, right? And so there's the wistful part of that. Then there's also, like... Did you ever see, was it John Belushi was like
the thing that wouldn't leave.
The thing that wouldn't leave is like, hey, can I order some pizza? And they're like, no. And he's like, you guys got any records? Like, it's like that
I'm
going to
make some
like,
long distance phone calls.
Yeah. I want somebody to go and, I you know, both of you guys know about this. I come from a small town.
It's true.
And
you are the John Mellencamp of this group.
Oh, I was thinking of it like I come from a small town down there. I don't know why I'm thinking
of. Well, Mellencamp was born in a small town.
And
he'll die in a small town.
No.
Yeah. It's apparently like a pink house.
Yeah. And it'll be a small pink house.
When are you guys, we got to get to Mellencamp at some point. And I, you know, I go back to this said small town periodically. And sometimes I'll see guys or...
Kerberg?
Yes. Women that I went to high school with or junior high with. And they look like when we were in high school together, they looked young and fresh and full of potential. And now they have these plumber shirts on. And nothing that there's, not that there's anything wrong with that. I mean, that was a...
Are you being a plumbist?
Thank you. I'm sorry. What I mean is some sort of uniform in some way, and
don't make a crack.
That's good. Thank
sure,
you so much.
I'm five.
They never said goodbye, is what I'm saying. They never said goodbye, and then they moved on to some job, and then they had some kids, and I want to know if. Somebody tell me if these guys, do they think about, since they never left, do they, when every time they drive past that high school, does that song play in their head?
You know,
do they think about themselves in high school?
Well, yeah. And the other thing that nobody ever talks about is like, so is there a statute of limitations on how long you care? You know what I mean? And the reality is that there is, but what.
About high school?
Well, about anything that you're wistful about.
I mean, I can
about.
Get wistful about
like,
that stuff.
I think like, I went to a football game or two, like, the year after I graduated, and then after that I was just like, yeah.
Oh, no. That's a whole different thing. That's participating with people that are still in high school that you're friends with. I mean,
right.
That's a whole different. But I'm saying, like, there are definitely times when you're talking to friends. I don't know if either of you are still friends. I mean, I'm pretty sure you are.
I will actually see people that I went to high school with that I keep up with very few people that I went to high school with who are all, like, as far as I'm concerned, decent, fine human beings, but not all of them. But the ones that I keep up with, I don't keep up with very regularly, and I certainly don't put much effort into it. And it's through no fault of theirs, but I just don't run in those circles.
Yeah,
like, yeah, you move on.
Oh, this is so goddamn depressing. Can we get back onto the Bon Jovi thing?
Anyway,
which is not depressing at all because this
oh no, it's pretty fucking hilarious.
Well, I guess let me just put a bow on this.
Well, I wanted to put a bullet in my head while I was listening to this record. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, that kind of depressing. All right, I got
it. I guess the point is that you can get trapped. This is what I was getting at. You can get trapped in sort of the genie in the bottle type situation where you want to
Christina Aguilera bears
or
that's a good kind of genie in the bottle situation. I think
maybe a snow
globe.
You
gotta rub it the right way.
Maybe a snow globe is a better
so to speak
metaphor. Like, just sort of trapped in this one particular moment. And what that ends up becoming over time is either something that you require to, like, be in that one place, or you put it on a shelf and you get on with the rest of your life. And my guess is that more people get on with the rest of their life than don't.
But the protagonist in Never Say Goodbye
did not
on with the rest of his life.
The cynical marketing plan for this record, this song fits right into it.
Of course it does.
You know, just that... That premature nostalgia for, you know,
those
knowing
kids
that these
were
are
down.
The best times of your life and these are your
he's,
best
he's
friends.
He's McConaughey and Dazed and Confused.
Yeah. All right.
Much, I'm a little more of a drinker than a pothead.
Yeah, that's probably you too.
So we, or did you want to go? I see you reaching for that. Do you want to read us a little more?
Yeah.
There?
So this is interesting. So in the middle of this, like, I wanted to circle back to this Rolling Stone review because in the middle of it, the guy changes tack. And he's like, So he rolls out every cliche that he could think of, which I shared earlier. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of it, he says, okay, maybe I'm being unfair. Nobody listens to Bon Jovi's brand of pop metal for its lyrics. They listen because they want to bang their heads lightly. Like, which sounds like a compliment, but it's not. He's like, it's a canny marketing strategy, which is like, I think that's kind of where you can couch this record, is like, mm-hmm. it's a marketing strategy. But Bon Jovi's band is barely functional. Guitar solos pop up like afterthoughts. Bass lines whine like spoiled children, and John Bon Jovi's voice is double and triple tracked in half-hearted attempts to cloak its blandness. Bon Jovi stumbles into sentimental territory and Never Say Goodbye, but Delicacy is not the band's strong suit. Meatloaf is subtle compared to these guys.
That's unfair.
Yeah, and then he calls out the callous clinker. Remember when we lost the keys and you lost more than that in my backseat? Is Bon Jovi's idea of evocative storytelling?
I love that he talks about how his vocals are double and triple tracked. When I was listening to this record a couple of days ago, and I re-listened to it today before we got in here, and a couple nights ago, I was thinking like, I really think they spent so much of the money on disguising the fact that his vocals are double-tracked, and I definitely think that they're triple-tracked after listening to him today, but they spent a lot – it takes a lot of time and effort and money to – I mean, double-tracking is most of the time used not to – well, I mean, oftentimes it's used to fill up a voice, but a lot of times it's used as an effect.
Well, and can you explain to the audience who might not know what double-tracking
is?
Yeah, what that
so
is.
You have like a – somebody sings a line, let's say, you lost more than that, my backseat, baby. And then it sounds a little thin or whatever. And then they go back in and they try to, and they sing a separate vocal track and try to double every syllable that they sang before.
To make it more full.
To make it fuller. Yeah. But usually that fullness, you can tell. It's sort of like when you look at a Ray Harryhausen movie. I mean, that shit looks cool. But you can definitely tell
that this is stop motion.
It's superimposed.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can tell that there's two things, you know, and that's how double and triple track vocals work, or historically have worked. And so for somebody to go in there, I mean, they spent a lot. I'd love to see what the budget is on this record. They did 4 or 5 months of recording in Canada for, you know, however many tracks they were going to do eventually. Like, that's in the 80s with tape. I mean, that's millions of dollars.
Well, right. And coming off of the previous record, like, if it is a marketing strategy, like this guy said, like, they clearly have done their focus groups. They've done their research. They have figured out sort of what the levers and the knobs are that you got to twist and pull.
Well, the motherfucker could write hooks. I mean, there is that. I mean, here, excuse me. Here's the thing about all of this is that, yes, these songs are – the lyrics are insane. They're inane / insane. And I didn't want to rhyme, but I realized at the last second I was about to.
You're a poet, and you did not realize that you were a poet at that juncture.
Thank you, Ryan. And – and see, you wanted to steer clear of the easy trap I just fell into.
That's right.
Didn't you? Yeah. So I could easily understand why the label would have some faith in them. There are some. The guy could. I mean, couldn't sing for shit. The band isn't very great. Richie Sambora, you know, I hate this kind of music, but the guy is a decent player and he gets a decent tone. Whatever. But the hooks that they have. I hate the way this record sounds. I fucking cannot stand it. I will never listen to it again in my entire life. But on purpose.
Yeah.
But Living on a Prayer, for example, is one of the hookiest songs I've ever heard in my life. I remember when I was a kid, skating my friend Robbie's mini ramp, and my brother was over there. I remember going like, this song will never get old, Living on a Prayer. And it quickly did, but it's brilliant hooks. Well, and it's got a bunch of them in that song.
You know, I was talking to some friends at work about I had to go listen to Bon Jovi's Slippery When Wet, and one of my coworkers, who's about 3 years younger than me, was like, "Oh, like no, I like that record." I was like, "How could?" I was like, "You're a nice person, but you're wrong.
Like, it's a terrible, terrible record.
No.
And she's like, well, I will admit that, you know, all of my memories of it are, like, tied up with going to the skating rink, you know, when she's, you know, in...
As are Kevin's, apparently.
Fifth grade,
apparently.
Or, you know, what have you. So, you know, now that we're adults and we recognize cynical marketing for what it is, like, they at least knew their market,
well,
you know, pitch it to the kids.
But I want to say this about Living on a Prayer. Specifically, years and years ago, I was in the car. I was actually going to Pharmaco to get some medical testing for money, which I did many times over the years.
Bartel, human guinea pig.
I was a human guinea pig. Hey, you know what? Robert Rodriguez made El Mariachi with Pharmaco money, so.
Sure.
So I went, yeah. So I was in, I was.
What did you make?
For that study in particular, I don't remember. Oh, I mean, the long haul over the. Was probably $15,000 to $20,000, like over the course of the
inconsiderable
10 years that I did it. But I was in the car going to, and I borrowed my fucking roommate's car, and it was stuck on. It wouldn't play CDs, and it was stuck on one radio station, and I had to listen to this radio station, and I was super hungover, even though I wasn't supposed to drink in the study. I would just buy mints and like take mints when I went in, so they couldn't. Smell the alcohol.
Mr. Rico Suave over
here. Yeah. They still paid me. I'm sure that I screwed up. Like, I'm sure that right now people are having side effects somewhere
because your lab work was all off.
Yeah. But we were, I was in the car driving to the research facility in the morning, and Living on a Prayer came on, and I'm hungover, and I'm a little delirious, but I was amazed at how hooky that song is. I mean, the lyrics are fucking inane and stupid. But the chorus and the pre-chorus and the verse are amazing. It's I know you don't want to hear this. I know you're fucking. I can see you rolling your eyes at me. But it's
no,
really
it's reminding me of something that I'll bring up in a minute.
Oh, okay.
Well, and I have a hard time separating that song from Omnipresent Anthem. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Listening to it critically is like it's difficult to give it first ears because it's been around.
True. Well, I guess the reason why I'm able to now is at the time, and this is a little while back, I hadn't heard it in so long, and this is before, this is when Bon Jovi was in their fallow period that a lot of bands like, you know, Motley Crue or whatever, they go through their very uncool, very never listened to fallow period, and then all of a sudden they become... Kiss, same thing. They become somewhat popular again, whether it be kitschy or not. And this is
nostalgia. So,
nostalgia, right? And I hadn't heard them in a long time. I hadn't heard this song in a long time, and I distinctly remember turning it up, and then turning it up again.
Well, oddly enough, Shane, I don't know if you know this about me or Kevin, if you remember this. When I was in eighth grade, I got saved. I briefly joined the
Ryan,
local mega church.
Ryan came in with two outs in the ninth.
Yeah, that's right. I closed as well. Yes. I like went through it. It was my eighth grade year. I got real religious, and I would go to.
How long did this last?
I don't remember.
Roughly
a
year.
Totally remember that, but I kind of remember it.
Yeah, I think the beginning of the end was when I went to your New Year's Eve party.
Sorry.
Yeah, and I drank wine coolers for the first time.
Did you throw up?
Well, the quote that I remember is somebody saying to you, Newsom, your brother's fucked.
Because clearly this was a cornpone gathering.
Were you in a field?
We were not in a field.
I was on the stairs. I remember that. I'd had like three wine coolers in. And I was kind of fucked.
Well, and that was that. And we can go down the rabbit hole in that story. But
anyhow, yeah. Living on a Prayer was one of the few secular songs that the Metropolitan Baptist Church, the local mega church, approved of.
Turbo
for
Church.
For our consumption. So I remember, like, you know, really trying to get behind it because I felt like it was compatible with my newfound, you know, Jesus-dom.
Jesus-dom?
Well, you know, my piety, if you will.
Yes. Well, in my head, when you said Jesus dumb, now I get it. But originally, like, I put D-U-M-B in there.
Jesus dumb.
Yeah, it was like, you know, never mind. Why don't we stop and why don't we just listen to the song so we can get a reference?
All right. So this is Living on a Prayer. Let's do Living on a Prayer. Here we go. Tell me you to work on the docks. Union's been on strike. So tough.
feeling newly pious again already.
Are you?
Oh, yeah.
You know, were you praying because you were praying to die?
I could think of some things to do with pies.
Well, anyhow, yes, living on a prayer. And I really think it was only because it has the word prayer in the title that, you know, they didn't really think it through a whole lot. If they listen to the rest of the record, you know, what with all the rocking.
Oh, no. And the orgasmic sounds.
The orgasmic sounds, you know, you lost more than that in my backseat, baby, if you know what I mean.
Do you guys know that there's this...
Contact. She lost a contact.
She lost
contact lens, yeah.
There's a band in Round Rock. God damn it, I can't remember their name right off the top of my head. But they cover secular songs and put in...
Like Jesus-centric
Jesus
vocals?
Lyrics. Yeah. It's brilliant, brilliant stuff. But I used... No, never mind. I'm taking away.
And I do think that, like... this is a whole side discussion we won't get into... But I do think that it's kind of interesting. One conversation that Ryan and I have had off the air before is that, like, there are certain bands in all genres, including the Christian genre or any other genre for that matter, that are good for that genre, that are like, okay, you're actually advancing what a particular genre should be and you're challenging what that is. But I do feel like songs like Living on a Prayer, they were designed to be literal, they were taken as literal, and they're like... Like, now we look back through a sort of 3D prism, and you're like, well, it's kind of a 2D or a 1D song.
It's pretty rote.
Yeah. Hey, I'm gonna have to go here just for a second. I was trying to look at the name of that band in Round Rock, but I want to read a little bit of this to you real quick. Christian in quotes, rock music, Christian or satanic?
Is there a question?
Right. Well, so the track carefully details the biblical screens any music must pass before it is labeled as Christian. The music must contain correct doctrine, and its lyrics should be edifying, spiritually oriented, clear, conforming to biblical truth, and point our focus to Jesus Christ. Its score should not overshadow the message conveyed by the lyrics, but should complement it. Its character, the attitudes in the music and of the performers, should be consistent with the purity of the message it claims to convey.
Other than that, kids, just go out there and have fun.
Well, I think they were living on a prayer, but a different kind of prayer that this.
Well, and you know, Gina dreams of running away. When she cries in the night, Tommy whispers, baby, it's okay. Someday. Yeah, so I don't know if that's a strict Christian ideology or.
Well, I mean, that's a.
But I do think that it speaks to what you were saying about, like, that this band, like, lyrically. This band, like, seems to have it. They want to have it always.
They
want to
be
time.
Wholesome.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
dangerous. Sexy. Dangerous. Yeah. Riding in the... Oh, my God. There's the last song on the album called Wild in the Streets. It's not a very wild song. Of all of my favorite lyrics that are amazing by Bon Jovi, this is probably my favorite. Other than the best lyrics ever written in rock and roll history, which we've already covered.
Of course.
Sometimes you talk so tough, your feet don't touch the ground. The fuck does that mean?
Well, I mean, it's talking so tough that you levitate.
like somebody hit you on the jaw and you, like, fall over in a comedic way.
It's a scientific fact, not a lot of people know this, that when you talk tough, you actually get lighter. And sometimes if you talk tough enough, you actually are lighter than gravity.
That shit is deep.
It is.
Did you go smoke a bowl in a bathroom when we took the break?
No, I went on spring break with Alfonso Cuarón, and now I just can't keep
talking about it. I don't think Kevin smoked a bowl since he tried to start his Coke machine.
That actually happened. That's a story for another time. Then maybe that will be the launch to another
episode. I'm
writing
it down right now.
But, yeah. I had a very, very, very brief but interesting foray with being cooler than I actually am. So anyway, I guess circling back.
Did you just couch it in those terms, that just in case your daughter hears it at some point?
Yeah, right. Yeah,
that's your euphemism for pot smoking and being cooler than you actually are.
Hey, do you remember when Dad said, "Don't do those things that I did"? I mean, they're so elaborate and ridiculous. She'd be like, "What are the odds?" Like, anyway. One other little oh,
Well, no.
Okay, one other little nugget that I wanted to share was, so one of the things that I mentioned to Shane was that, and we talked a little bit about, was the idea that finding good source material that was like in the moment critically about this band was difficult. Mostly because all of the mediums have changed and a lot of those publications aren't around anymore and there just aren't necessarily great records. There aren't great records. That's a double entendre. So anyway, one of the things that I thought was really interesting was I actually found an old CMJ review of Crush, which was the reuniting of all the guys from Slippery When Wet, all six members of that band or whatever. I won't go through all of it because it doesn't all exactly apply directly. But basically, most critics seem to agree that it was kind of intended to be an extension of Slippery When Wet, because by that time, they all knew how much that record had sold, and they all had presumably bought, you know, leopard skin couches or cars. And
was Bon Jovi in this band?
The Bon Jovi record Crush came out 6 years after Slippery When Wet, so 1992. Oh,
I have never heard of this.
Of course you don't. Yeah, but apparently there was a Tommy and Gina like like a song in there, and they were like one of the reviewers was like
Tommy and Gina's saga has continued.
Yeah, no, it had settled down,
got a couple kids now.
It had a continuation.
Really?
And somebody was like, oh well, it looks sounds like they're doing okay. Like that's a real thing. But ultimately they like where this thing kind of wrapped up, and I thought this was really apropos was that they just mentioned what Bon Jovi's ultimate limitations are, which are that they're good musicians with big hearts and the collective imagination of a set of hubcaps. So
they're the same guy that wrote the review before, right?
It's not the same guy. And they were on Island Def Jam by this time. So there's a little bit of like you learn a little bit of it. Some of it is just, you know, companies get acquired by other companies in the music business, but sometimes it's also like these big bands move where they think they can get distributed best, and then history colors them the way they can. The fact that nobody knows this record, but it
they were deeply uncool by this time.
If it was
6 years after,
it's 1992.
Yeah, so that would have been right after Nevermind.
Oh yeah. Which would be what people were saying.
There
about
is
this
nothing less cool than being in Bon Jovi in 1992.
but see now we're all saying this right now, and I agree completely with that. But
that said, Bon Jovi is one of the highest grossing acts of last year.
That and also if one were to Google Slippery When Wet attempting to procure information about the Slippery When Wet album, one will be proffered the Wikipedia entry to the Slippery When Wet tour. Who the fuck wants to go and read about the Slippery When Wet tour? Because all it is, essentially, are a list of dates.
Tommy and Gina.
Yeah, they get drunk sometimes. Yeah. I don't think Tommy and Gina are together anymore. That came out in 1992.
Also,
all right.
One of the biggest.
I bet
you
Richie Sambora does. I bet you that motherfucker gets drunk and gets on Wikipedia. He's like, "What did we? Where was I? Let's go Slippery When Wet tour."
I did this,
motherfucker.
The other thing about that song that strikes me is that one of like the main like drive it home parts is like Gina saying to Tommy, "It's okay." Like that's the high water mark. Is like it's fine.
Yeah,
like,
baby, it's okay.
Yeah.
No. Tommy says that to Gina.
It is true. Tommy
or
does
either
say
way,
it to Gina.
I don't.
Yeah, get your
honestly,
shit right, dude.
There was solace offered.
And I'm sure, probably solace needed.
He used to work on the docks, but the union men were on strike.
Man, that's a bitch.
So we're hoping he went back to the docks. I don't know. I haven't listened to the. Do you have any lyrics? Do you have any?
Any updates on the Tommy and Gina saga?
You just yanked that shit out.
I think it would be appropriate if Tommy and Gina showed up on Oprah, because that would have been about the time where.
Sure.
Although I think they would have done Springer.
Okay.
I think Springer's more their speed.
Yeah. Tommy threw a chair at Gina. And
the Slippery When Wet Tour was a concert tour by American hard rock band Bon Jovi that ran from 1986 through to 1987. The tour was put on in support of the band's multi-platinum 1986 album Slippery When Wet. No shit. The tour was the first major worldwide tour for the band, visiting places such as Australia and Canada for the first time. And other than that, you basically just have fucking tour dates and the fact that they had the same set list. So you guys are sitting here saying, like, or you especially are sitting here saying that it was deeply uncool and nobody knew about it. We sure as shit did, because obviously we were very cool at the time and now. But somebody gave a shit so much
to write a Wikipedia page
about the fucking tour that Bon Jovi went on, which arguably is one of the worst albums I've ever heard in my entire life.
I'm with you, dude. I mean, it's no, if you step to me with your bullshit, I'm going to have to ask you please to quit.
I feel like that's going to make a recurring, that's going
to
be a recurring
yeah, oh,
theme,
speaking
like,
of reoccurring, I just have to, so, whoa, where's the chalice?
Where
is the chalice, Kevin?
Yeah,
so we have a substitute chalice tonight. Chalice tonight brought to you by,
brought to you by
our friends at Aviary.
Thank you, Aviary.
Yes. Aviary, thanks for something for Kevin to drink out
of. We're grateful for Aviary, but but yeah, this chalice is a little bit different. The chalice that I have in our garage home is more of a sort of mini goblet. And this chalice is actually a glass minted by the folks at Unibrew or that make Le Fin du Monde. So it is it's a little bit different, but still we didn't spill any. And so we're making do with a different chalice tonight in honor of our friends over here at Aviary.
Huzzah. Let's start wrapping this up, but we talked about this earlier. Wanted Dead or Alive. Kevin, you said that.
Yeah, one of the things that I said is, like, this is the one song off this record. It actually, I didn't know before we sat down here tonight that that's what they wanted to call the record. Like, I guess maybe I didn't skim the Wikipedia thing very closely, but I didn't know that that's what they originally had talked about calling the record, and I think, for me, it's the one song on that record. I mean, it still sounds overproduced. Like, there's sort of, there's no way, like, they were.
There's not
as
many keyboards in it.
They were not.
Well, there are.
They were of their time, and they did things the way that they did them. But, and let's be honest, like, it's literally a cowboy song. But it's
seen through the lens.
But it's the only one. It's the only one where they don't sound like, to use the, it's a weird dog pound metaphor, but it's the only one where they don't try to sound like the loudest puppy in the box, like, or loudest puppy in the pen. Like, they're not the one that's trying to get adopted first. Like, I think most of their songs come off like trying too hard. And that song at least has some restraint. And I thought that was actually pretty interesting. And of all of them, it's the one that I can listen to that doesn't make my skin crawl. Like,
I wouldn't quite go that far.
That's for me.
I do have a question. Has anyone on Earth, other than John Bon Jovi, ever referred to a motorcycle as a steel horse? Is that a thing?
Or loaded six string on his back?
Loaded six string on my back.
I mean, that's at the point where it really starts.
Well,
another one where he talks about the bottle. Sorry, Kevin.
Yeah, the bottle does make an appearance.
Sure. No, and I, like, it actually totally makes sense. But I think that maybe this is my issue. Maybe that's the thing. It's like, that's a band that's really good at uncovering blind spots in people who listen to popular music. Like, most of that record is just so jump up and down, wave your hand around, pick me, and that. For all of the cliche lyrics that are in that song and every other one, that's the one where I'm able to ignore them a little bit for whatever reason. Like,
it's a little more of a subtle song.
It is a little bit more subtle.
So I have a very important question for both of you to answer. And, so if you're at the high school dance and this song comes on, is it a slow dance?
I think it's a slow jam.
It's a slow jam, like you like kind of grind to
I
it.
I think this is actually one of those songs where everybody just retires to their individual corners and it gives them a break.
Yeah.
Because that does happen.
It does happen. Quick sidebar, I was at a dance that a friend of mine was DJing,
And he had the.
Was this in high school?
This was in high school, and he unfortunately decided that to put on the Police's "Walking on the Moon," and I was like, "Dude, you're gonna clear the place." And
everybody went for a breather.
He did, but he never got them back either.
Yeah, that's tough with songs like that. It's like where you can lose yourself into them as a music fan, mm-hmm. but you don't understand the dynamics of a dance floor. Like those are two different things. And I do think, like, maybe to answer Shane's question or your question directly before. It's a head bob number. Like
it's a head bob?
Yeah. It's a head bob. So it's not, you know, and Walking on the Moon's the same way. Like they're
I feel like you're supposed to get like a wistful look in your eye and kind of stare off into the distance.
The faraway stare.
The faraway
stare.
No,
that's what guys get that live through the 80s on the Sunset Strip. When they hear these songs, they get a faraway wistful look in their eyes.
Yeah, I remember them
days. I've got a story about the first party I ever went to with glam rockers on the Sunset Strip, and this was 15 years after their prime. That's another show.
Are we saving that one?
All right. We're saving that one.
So before we jump to the next song, and I think we should.
Oh no, I want to read something.
Go ahead then.
I just want to read the background, the Wikipedia background on One Dead or Alive. And again, and I'm probably going to say this every show that we do, where I reference Wikipedia in any way. It's amazing to me that these entries are written by people with hard-ons for these bands. You'll be able to tell this real quick. Okay, the background.
Before you get into it, and we don't have to sidebar on this for very long, but do you think that the reason that happens is they don't get scrubbed very hard because the public at large doesn't care that it's balanced? Or that because those people are so vigilant that they just go in and like re-update? Like,
both. Well, I think a lot of times they're the people that originally start that.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about this, like, I don't think that Bon Jovi cares about there being individual Wikipedia entries for his individual songs.
Sure.
I mean, he probably does for his albums. I guarantee he doesn't give a fuck about the Slippery When Wet tour and what set list they played in 1987. So the background on the Wikipedia page for Wanted Dead or Alive... We quickly see in this entry that it is written by someone with an admiration for John.
Uh-oh.
The song's title pays homage to John's admiration for Old West heroes and how he identifies with them as being hated, in parenthetically, wanted dead or alive. During an interview on Inside the Actors Studio, John said he got the inspiration for the song early one morning when he couldn't sleep while riding in a tour bus. And here's where we go to the quotes. The quote, lifestyle of every rock band was similar to that of the Outlaws in that each was a young band of thieves riding into town, stealing the money, the girls, and the booze before the sun came up. End quote.
That is so true.
Can I just, I think I we've know. Got, at the very least, a runner-up for best lyrics ever.
wait, are they both Bon Jovi lyrics?
Yes. Well, I just, one is from Wanted Dead or Alive at, and bear with me, I'm going to do the whole stanza. I walk these streets, a loaded six string on my back. I play for keeps because I might not make it back. Granted, he's talking about touring in a bus, but I've been everywhere, and I'm standing tall. I've seen a million faces, and I've rocked them all. Yeah.
No, it's all, and it's terrible. Like, it's all.
He rocked them all, Kevin.
I know.
I don't think you're getting
a million faces.
It is.
They've all been sufficiently rocked.
They've all been rocked. It's like, what about the rest of them? Hey, why only the faces?
why don't you play some of this song?
All right. So, this is Wanted Dead or Alive?
Yes, please.
Let's do it. Wanted Dead or Alive.
Only the name will change. Steel horse, I
the only time that all three of us
we're
have
speechless.
Been speechless.
Yeah. Like, I mean, what can you say about the
so
masterpiece that is Dead or Alive?
I felt like all of our thoughts were getting jumbled all at once, like who was going to say the funnier line.
Well, I mean, here's one thing that I will put out there is that if this was an homage to the cowboy era, like his, you know, he was big into those guys. None of them are wanted alive anymore. They're all dead. Like, they're all dead.
It's true.
Like, it's like the worst search in history.
I want to know if you know, and he's saying that if it's an homage to the gunslingers wanted dead or alive, like how, not just an homage, how he's comparing the two of them. Like, okay, so if you think that you're wanted dead or alive, it's got to mean that you think if people want you dead, that they think your music is shitty. So you've got to have some form of self-awareness. So going back to being cynical, there you go.
But I don't think that's a, like, that's not a straight line either. Like,
no, he says that in the quote that I just said.
He says, I'm wanted.
He
said, wanted, but dead or alive.
Oh, sorry. My bad, fellas.
Okay. We got it. You had something that you wanted to tell us, Kevin.
Yeah. So I also found a really great write up of that subsequent record, Crush. But like all of those,
which I've never heard of.
I know none of us have because, like Ryan was saying, it got blanketed out by Nevermind and everything and, good yeah. that came of later time. So anyway, but everybody had to review it. Because I'm sure it was being pushed by the label, like, this is the original lineup that put out this thing, and they sold 25 million records, and so you have to give it time. But what ends up happening is that all of these...
This was the nail in the coffin of hair metal?
Well, maybe so. But beyond that, like, they all, like, half of the copy is really about the previous record. So in that sense, like, it's like they had to provide context for people because the world had changed so much that it just wasn't the same anymore. So anyway, and this one's British, so this is great. he says, this is from Enemy Magazine. He says,
New Musical Express,
yes,
for those of you who don't know.
Yes, he says, so Crush is basically Slippery When Wet, part 26, with a couple of really bad ballads. That's the subhead. he says, it's a proving fact that if you sing the lyrics, shot through the heart, and you're to blame, in the company of two or more people, then at least one of them will join you in singing You Give Love a Bad Name while playing air guitar and gritting their teeth. The problem with Bon Jovi is that while all this is well and good, when you're 13 or musically deluded, it's hard to like them if you're not. The short version is, while a fantastic actor, I don't know about that, charismatic frontman and caring family man, also supposition, John Bon Jovi can come across a little soulless and businesslike. It's hard to get down with his Bruce Springsteen-like working on the docks vibes as he flies above you in his private jet laughing his dick off. You have to sort of wait for that line. But he says still he can write a good cheesoid rock tune, and at least he sticks to what he knows. And I think that you can, if you're mining the dirt for the silver lining, that's the thing. It's like that guy knows who he is, and he almost bought the Buffalo Bills. Like
that's the most schizophrenic album review I have ever read in my life.
It's true. It's pretty schizoid, but I think the point that he ultimately makes is actually kind of true, which is that...
But that doesn't... Sure. But that doesn't belong in an album review. Basically, what that guy is trying to say is, I'm going to disparage and rip apart your music in every way, but you're an all right guy.
John Bon Jovi as a person rather than...
Right. So that's how he has to...
Well, the other thing is, it's five... Like, so they use a 10-star system or whatever, and it's 5 out of 10. So, like, where did the 5 come from? Like, you're kind of, like...
Right.
It's... He's sort of,
it's almost it's like, you know what it feels done. Like to me? Like he met Bon Jovi, or his editor met Bon Jovi slightly before that, and he's like, I would never give you a shitty review. But then he couldn't live with himself when writing a nice review, so he wrote that backhanded compliment review or something like that.
It is, and we could probably do 50 minutes on street cred versus like artistic and journalistic street cred.
No, this is
like
just
whatever.
Shitty music. I mean, there's street cred and there's artistic credibility and there's everything in the above, and there's everybody's individualistic taste and what we all like. But I think that every person in this room can definitely agree on the fact that this album fucking sucks.
Oh, it's a giant turd.
And I've said all the stuff I have to say about there are brilliant hooks on it, but taken as a whole, it sounds like it's produced by a shiny robot It sounds like it's written by
shiny robot wearing chaps.
Wearing chaps. I think that the reason Bon Jovi, and I've come to this conclusion over the course of the show, the reason that Bon Jovi, John Bon Jovi, not the band Bon Jovi,
John Bon Giovanni.
Yes, the reason that that he mentions the word rock, so references rock and slash roll so many times in his songs. Is because he knows his songs don't actually rock.
He has to remind you that that's what he's going for. Like,
yeah. By the way, go ahead and rock now.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. As now you rock. So I wanted to say this, and this is kind of how I want to wrap this up real quick. And this will answer a question for you, Ryan, that you've been asking me all night, off and on, that I did not have the answer to previously, but I do now.
You found the wisdom.
I found the wisdom. So there's a quote from, well, let me just read from the Wikipedia, and I hate to keep doing this, but sometimes I'm finding so much comedy in them.
With bands that are polarizing, I think Wikipedia is gold. Like, it's gold.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm learning this now. Despite the moderate success of 7,800 degrees Fahrenheit, Bon Jovi weren't becoming the superstars they had hoped. Of course, everybody hopes to become superstars. The album went gold, by the way. And they changed their approach for their next album, going for a more mainstream sound than their heavier first two records. Okay, so as we go out of here, not as before we go out, but I want you to play a song, Kevin, off of their album, 7,800 Degrees Fahrenheit, which, and I'm sure you will all be pleased to know this, I have now discovered the meaning behind the title, 7,800
Ooh,
Degrees Fahrenheit.
Tell. Should we tease it and then...
No, I'll tell you right now.
Oh.
Because it needs to be said.
Okay.
But before we listen to their harder rocking songs.
Okay.
The album's title was a reference to the supposed melting point of...
Metal?
Rock.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah. It rocks so hard that it melts the
rock. It rocks so hard, they melted the rock. So I'm going to let you guys listen to the song real quick. It's called The Price of Love. And this is an album... that Bon Jovi made before, or this is off an album that Bon Jovi made before Slippery When Wet, that only went gold, and before they
when I only sell 500,000 records.
before they radically altered their sound. Here's a song, The Price of Love, 7,800 degrees Fahrenheit.
So the other thing that I found that was kind of interesting on this record was I did a little bit of digging on Last FM, which is not always current, but neither is this record.
Like last week's FM?
Yeah, right, exactly. But in this case, Last Millennium's, whatever. Yeah. So the band bio on Bon Jovi, and specifically related to this record, said it was the top selling album of 1987 by Billboard. And is currently, and I don't, this is why I couch it that way. It's like, I don't know if this is current as of time of publishing or if this is still current. I'm going to guess maybe as of time of publishing, which means it may be way out of date. But still, it's kind of crazy to think that it was the 21st best-selling studio album of all time and is featured in the book.
You've got to be kidding me.
Is featured in the book 1001 albums you must hear before you die.
I saw this.
I can only guess.
I didn't want to believe it.
I can only guess it's the last one.
Yeah, it's 1001.
When you're on your way out to help speed
here,
it along.
This ought to do it.
Yeah. this guy is just hanging in there, isn't he? Check this out.
Hang on. Anybody, you got the headphones? All right, let's do it.
Yeah, so. Dad's been hanging around a little too
poor,
long.
Poor
musical
grandpa.
Euthanasia.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, guys, I'm not sure what we all learned today.
I learned the melting point of rock.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, 7,800 degrees. Yeah. You know what? We all definitely know that now. I don't think we're going to do a seance anymore. I do want to thank Avery again for Aviary.
some guy that came
out. Yeah, but very, very short version. If you make it down to South Lamar, you're in Austin, stop by Aviary. These guys will treat you good. And they have been very, very sweet to us. So thanks, thanks, Marco and friends.
Yes, thank you very much. Guys, do you have anything else to say?
What do we have coming
up? We'll talk about it. Yeah.
So, okay, so originally we had talked about the last time that you guys asked me, I thought we were going to do – I was seriously considering doing a whole record, and I do think that that's one that I want to do, but I don't think it's
like
what I want to –
Like an entire record or
we had talked about doing the Courtney Love Band whole Live Through This.
Yes.
And we're going to do it, but I want to put it off. And it's because I think I want to do NWA Straight Outta Compton. If you think about it, like, it's a pretty interesting story. One of those guys is Eazy-E. One of those guys is Ice Cube, who is certainly not as scary as he used to be. He's in kids' movies.
Well, he's not using his AK these days.
He's not. And the other one,
he said he didn't. Today was a good day.
It was a good day.
A good day because he didn't have to use his AK.
Exactly.
Right. And the other one, just is essentially a billionaire. So there is far from the streets as they could ever be. But that is not what that record sounds like. And it also captures a very particular slice of what that version of L.A. was at that time. And so I think it'd be interesting territory to mine. It's a record that I don't know, but that influences so many other things. And I thought it would be really fun to unearth it a little bit.
I think that's a great idea. We were talking about I can re-reference Killer Tom when we talked about during the Beastie Boys. But I can also reference little slice of life stuff. The first time I ever heard NWA was by a friend of mine named Judd. And Judd was a couple years older than me in high school. And his sole drink of choice was he would only drink Gatorade and peppermint schnapps. And I asked him once, why do you drink peppermint schnapps and mix it with Gatorade? And straight-faced, serious answer, he said, because it gets it into your bloodstream faster.
That sounds about right.
Science.
That's
really kind of hoping you'd said, because I get down.
It's a very well-known fact, Shane.
Because I gets down.
Because I gets down.
I just assume that's the answer to everything.
All right, well, that's great. I can do that. So you're going to come back with – I'm relatively familiar with that album, but only in a party sense.
I've really been hoping to integrate the expression inward into my discourse. So I believe we'll have a lot of opportunity.
How are we going to navigate that? Because I take the Louis C.K. tack that every time you say the word, every time you say the word, or is it word or a phrase? I guess it's a word. The N word, it puts the real word
in
my brain,
head.
And it puts the onus on me.
And Louis C.K. also says that the real version of yourself is the lowest, most base version of yourself. And so, I don't know. I think we can explore that to some degree, but I really think that as a period piece, as a little mini musical museum, that particular record for that particular act at that particular time is worth talking about.
Yeah, so I mean, it's not like we're going to go – I don't think there's going to be any point where we all are going to need to definitely reference that word if it comes up on the track that we're playing. It's not like it's going to be and then Kevin's voice comes in and says inward.
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 We could do the Craig Ferguson thing where it's like I'm
okay,
inwards with attitude. Yeah.
Okay, so Ryan, so what are we going to do in 2 weeks? It's coming
in
back around
2 weeks, I felt like I needed a little bit of a counterbalance and brain scrub after the Bon Jovi experience. So I want to do, and I don't know this record all the way through. I know the band fairly well, but I want to do Pavements, Slanted, and Enchanted, which is not a record I know particularly well.
I know pretty much every other Pavement record than that one. That's
And I don't know it. So let's do it.
That's great. Okay, yeah, that's yay, good call. You guys both came up with good ones this week.
There you go.
Leaving me again.
To ruin it all
in three weeks. Well, I've got a little bit of time to think about it.
Good.
All right, we're signing off right now, you guys. Thanks for listening. It's Shane, Kevin, and Ryan, and Somebody Likes It. We'll see you in 7 days.